Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm excited to be able to have another conversation with my guest co-host, Greg Fuqua. Greg, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Mona. Super happy to be here.
Yeah, this is going to be a very, very important and helpful conversation because I know it's an issue that comes up pretty much all the time in the couple support groups that I facilitate and in the support groups that I facilitate for the non-autistic neurotypical partners. And today we're going to be talking about sexuality and sex and physical intimacy. And we're both going to be sharing things that I think will be helpful for all of you to think about, but also this is a conversation that can sometimes be really difficult for partners to have because of shame, because of embarrassment, because of feeling like you don't want to get it wrong. Mm-hmm. And I hope that if what we're talking about is helpful, that you'll be able to listen to this with your partner. Maybe you'll listen to it alone first, and then you'll be able to listen to it with your partner. Maybe the issues we bring up together in our conversation will help you bring them up with your partner. So I want to start first by sharing some of the things that I learned in my marriage. And I've always said this on the podcast, and I say it in the support group, and I get a lot of folks saying you're very fortunate. But one of the things that was always a positive in my marriage was our physical intimacy and our sex life. And what I believe to be is that it was a special interest and a passion for my ex. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I remember when we first started dating and getting a little bit more serious, he had shared with me that for many, many, many years, he would go to the library and he would read books like The Kinsey Report and mm-hmm. Masters and Johnson and all this stuff. And he had so much knowledge that I didn't have. I mean, we met at 21. I mean, he just had so much knowledge about women's bodies and sex and all of this. And I was enthralled, you know, and we were able to connect on that level for our entire relationship, even when things hit the rocks and we were not in a good place emotionally. We couldn't communicate well. We were even toxic. There was still sex going on, a lot of good sex and physical intimacy. But I do remember at the end of our relationship, I think it was even before we separated, I remember we were getting into so many conflicts. And one day I said to my ex, I said, I feel like you're using my body and I'm not okay with that. Mm. And I don't want to have sex with you anymore. And his response was, okay. And I was like,
what? Was it okay?
He was like, okay. I'm like, do you understand what mm-hmm. I'm saying? I mean, I don't know. You know, we didn't have much of a conversation beyond that. And of course, we did go back to sex. We did go back to having sex together. But the other thing that I realized, Greg, when I became familiar with the love languages is, and we both took the assessment, mm-hmm. We both had in common the love language of physical touch.
Right.
And so my ex's other love language was acts of service and mine was quality time. Mm-hmm. So if you think about that, you right. know, as a couple and especially as a neurodiverse couple, we connected on that physical touch for 32 years, but I wanted more socializing and more quality time. And he wanted me to give him acts of service. And I do wonder if sex for him was an act of service.
Yes.
And I didn't even realize it, right?
Yes.
So I have so much more to share about other relationships, but I'd like to turn it over to you after what I just shared.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of good things you're touching on, I think, as it relates to this topic. And yeah, just to reiterate that part of the difficulty here is, bringing this subject out into the open, and I think there is so much social difficulties with autistics. And then if there's another whole area of like private knowledge of how things are supposed to work, it really is important for us to be more educated around it. And your husband went to, healthy sources for that. It's possible to not go to healthy sources of that and the special interest to become maybe more of an obsession, an addiction. It can get a lot more deviant. But I think the way you framed it with the love languages, I think is really good too. And I think, a lot of autistics find their way in relationships by attending to other people's needs. So I know if I have value to you and I can do things for you, I will be accepted, right? And there's such difficulty with navigating social nuance that a lot of autistics kind of fall into that trap. Now, this can be good and bad in a lot of ways, right? So we get much more of a unidirectional sorts of interplay with physical intimacy. And also, autistics generally struggle with some types of connections with their body, being aware of what they want, what they feel, and it can become something that ends up, yeah, becoming not as reciprocal as it could be. So the acts of service, physical touch, important, and then what are the emotional components that are sometimes maybe overlooked? So, you talked about sort of being objectified, a lot of autistics see this as more of a physical need or can separate the emotion from sex. A lot of neurotypical women cannot do that, meaning there has to be a sense of commitment and emotional connection there to move toward that next step.
Yeah, for
And
sure.
there's a ton of variety and gray space all in between here that we can talk about. But from my experience, I had no clue what I was doing. And it was a lot of social anxiety about my sexuality, about navigating what's expected, what does this look like? I had no knowledge of women's anatomy or what that looked like. So I give a lot of kudos to your husband. I think educating is a really critical part of probably in particular in autistics, connection, understanding of sexuality, relational norms, a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and I think unfortunately, Greg, a lot of folks get their information from porn nowadays
Oh,
because
yeah.
it's so accessible. And it's funny, not funny, haha, but it's interesting, I should say, that after we separated, my ex and I, which was in 2016, we both dated. And then after the divorce, I dated and I'm still dating. And pretty much every man that I've been with is neurodivergent. Most of them have been autistic or autistic ADHD. And so what I have learned is so much because, every person is different and every person's interests are different and every person
Yeah.
is different, with physical touch and sexuality. And so as I've been open to listening and hearing and watching, there are some things that have become very apparent to me that I take into every new relationship with kind of a curiosity lens. and I'll share a few of those.
Good.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I've learned is that some folks are can be very hyper sexual. And one of the men I dated, I mean, like, he could have had sex numerous times a day, every day. And plus self-pleasure. And that was something that he like needed. He absolutely needed. And at the time, he didn't know he was autistic and learned later on in our dating. And I also, we didn't discuss this, but I wonder if this was a way of him self-regulating, right? And so he knew that it would not only bring him pleasure, but he could self-regulate. And he was very, very attentive in bed with me. And he was very comfortable with tantric sex. And so he was also very educated. And that was wonderful. But outside, again, outside of that, he could not necessarily commit to the emotional connection. But wow, he had great skill sexually. And then another guy that I dated, he told me that he had intimacy issues. And I wasn't sure what he meant by that. And, at the time, I didn't ask for more information, and I probably should have. And what I realized was he was a high functioning alcoholic. And before we had sex, he would have multiple drinks, Greg. I mean, many, many, many drinks. So I'm surprised he could perform, but he had figured it out. And so that helped him reduce his intimacy issues and whatever was going on so that he could perform. And for him, and now, I realize this for several of the men that I was with, there was a specific process that they went through, and it was a routine, sexually. And the routine was based on what they knew would be pleasurable to me. And they did it every single time the exact same way. And I didn't have complaints, Greg, but I'm sharing this because I hear this in the couple support groups and my individual support groups that it seems almost robotic, right? So, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Yeah.
I think this is in I think this goes also in potentially two different directions too, which is obviously, I think we want sex to be intuitive and in the moment and organic. But that's where autistics get the most lost because what does this look like? It's this, organic interaction between two people with two different personalities and two different bodies potentially. And, how do you navigate this, right? And so again, it becomes easy when you have structures or kind of rules or understand the lay of the land or understand the game of it, so to speak, And when autistics know kind of how it works at some point, there's a lot of comfort in that repetition, doesn't necessarily lead to a lot of spontaneity or creativity in the moment and responding to different senses of feel and need. But I think there are a lot of also individual and more diverse preferences with neurodivergent individuals. And we can get stuck in what's expected or what's normal around sexuality. And if we've got some gaps in thinking we're unsure what this is supposed to look like, then it's very easy to sort of defer back to these same patterns or these same processes that seem to work well enough, so to speak. But at the same time, I think we need room to explore our sexualities and where it can go that maybe aren't as normalized or typical or a little bit more divergent. And I think what we see in neurodivergent populations is a much higher rate of sexual diversity, sexual preferences, bisexuality, polyamory, asexuality to homosexuality, and even gender things, that, you know, and so how do people get there? You know, when a lot of times we're sort of feeling lost or we're unsure where to go. And I think there should be an openness also to be more verbal and really communicate around sexuality. And again, we talked about the healthiness of the debriefing process, which is you don't learn through experience, you learn by reflecting on experience. And the idea here is to be able to talk about what went well, what went wrong, what more do you want, what else could this look like, and to be open to that. And that can be hard to open up about. But generally speaking, neurodivergents that are more verbal will have more ability to express their full potential sexually than not. And so I think that's another good thing to sort of be aware of.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think there are issues that we're afraid to talk about around physical intimacy, and not even sex, but physical intimacy. And I'd love to explore that a little bit. You know, I was either reading or listening to something, and it was a neurodiverse couple, and they were talking about passive versus active touch. And so, yeah, I wanted to bring this up because I think it's so valuable. And I noticed in several of my relationships with autistic and autistic ADHD men that this played out. So for me, you know, active touch is very important. And what I mean by that is if we're walking around the mall or we're walking somewhere, I'm going to reach for your hand and I'm going to want to hold your hand possibly for a long time, right? Or if we're in the car, I'm going to touch your leg or your face or give you a kiss on the cheek. That's very active touch, right? And what I realized was that several of the men that I was with were not comfortable with that. In fact, you know, even a kiss when I came in the door was difficult. And at first, Greg, you know, because again, we didn't always know in the beginning that we were a neurodiverse couple. And then we discovered it over time. But I felt rejected at first, you know, and then I had to understand that I'm looking for active touch and my partner may only be able to give passive touch. And what that might look like is, and I saw this often, when I reach for my partner's hand to hold his hand, he'll hold it for a few seconds and then let's go. And then let's go of my hand. And so where I was feeling rejected, he was feeling like, okay, I gave Mona the touch she requested. I can let go now. The other thing might be when I touch my partner, like in the car or on the couch, that they get up and go for a drink, you know, or move over. And that's because they couldn't handle that much touch, you know, or they didn't want the touch, but they didn't want to hurt me. And I realized that after conversations. So do you have any thoughts about the idea of passive and active touch and what you think might help couples understand better?
I think this is a really good insight, you know, and something that maybe I wasn't even all that aware of until you described it for me too, which is the same sorts of things, you know, for my partner to breach my physical boundaries feels very intrusive. And particularly if I'm not ready, you know, and so, you know, one thing we have figured out is that I cannot maintain holding hands for very long. It's the same exact thing. And I also have to have her hand in a certain position. So my thumb has to be over the top of her thumb. So that the way we meet has to be a particular way. If it doesn't feel right, I absolutely can't do it. And you're right. It does become a little bit of a checkbox. Although I do like it, it's only up to a point. You know, the same thing. who initiates contact, and this can go to, sex talk too, who initiates sex, I think is a big, can be a big problem here. Because ultimately, I think autistics want our partners to, to make connections to us, but it's also very difficult for us to bridge that, to be ready for that, and to work through that, because again, a lot of what we deal with is sensory stuff. And so sensory stuff becomes a huge part of both physical intimacy and sexuality, and overlap into those things of it, where you may think of more sexual dysfunction for men in terms of premature ejaculation, reflex, erections, erection dysfunction. And it's very hard, it's very easy for us to get stuck in our heads and to be in our own internal worlds, and to have that breached suddenly is very difficult. So, my take is I'm okay with hugging people. I don't like, as I've talked about, like very passive hugs. I prefer a real hug, And I'm also a hugger in terms of my clients. If my clients are open to hugging, I don't mind hugging and doing that in boundaried and appropriate ways. But I always ask, always, always, always. So, hey, can I come in and get a squeeze, or, and I think that part of it can help. It still may feel awkward. There still may be some tension and resistance in terms of relaxing into that moment, because we're bracing ourselves for what might be too much.
I think that is so important for those of us that are not autistic to remember, because so much of this can feel like rejection and like our partners don't care about us and don't love us. And that's not what's going on. And I think being aware of both your sensory profile and your partner's sensory profile is so critical, because another thing that I didn't understand is one of the man that I was dating who had intimacy issues and kept asking me, "Do you think I'm autistic? Do you think I'm autistic?" And yes, he absolutely was and is. When we were intimate, when we were having sex, he could never open his eyes, ever open his eyes. It bothered me, at first. I'm like, "Can you open your eyes?" And he would open his eyes for a second, and then he'd have to close them right away. He could not. It was too emotionally intimate, I think, for him. And also, I think he couldn't concentrate on the act of sex. Right? So again, I figured it out, but not with feeling some hurt at the beginning. The other thing, and this has been with several of the men that I've been with, they don't want to cuddle. I was very used to, in my marriage, my ex and I would always cuddle after sex. We would sometimes lie in bed and fall asleep. And the men that I've been with that don't want to do that, at first I took it personally. I'm like, "Why do you not want to sit here and cuddle?" And I do wonder, and I'd love your thoughts on this. I do wonder if that's again too sensory overwhelming or too emotionally intimate. And of course, everybody's different. But just for those folks that are experiencing this, it could be a variety of things that are going on that you and your partner haven't fully understood and therefore haven't been able to talk about. So, any thoughts?
So I, again, to me, part of, and I've struggled with this too with my wife too, which is cuddling very quickly turns sexual for me. Which, which turns on, I get overstimulated very quickly, which turns into grinding, which turns into sex. And my wife is like, can't we just, can't we just cuddle? And can it just be about cuddling? Does it always have to go there? And so for me, that's hard. And so when you're in between that state, which is, is this sexual? Is it not? You know, what does it need to look like? I think that becomes difficult. And I think it's better for us when things are clear.
Sure.
You know, and so I really encourage my neurodiverse couples to practice more platonic cuddling, to get used to more physical touch that doesn't have more of an agenda on there. And sometimes you might have to basically outline that, you know, because otherwise it can go in those directions very quickly. It can also just be too much, you know, and sort of I had similar issues around visual information, you know, so I'm going to just touch on that really quick, which is looking into the eyes of my partner was always going to be too much, you know. So kissing or embracing where we're staring into each other's eyes, there's no way I can do that. I mean, I can't do that on the regular. I remember one of my first experiences in group therapy, my the facilitator, the therapist said, Greg, I want you to stare into this person's eyes, who was a female. And I just poured down tears and I couldn't stop. It was too much. It's like looking into the bottom of my soul. Someone's looking straight through me. And the other person was just fine with it. They were relaxed. They could look right into me. They could connect on that level. For me, it was too much. Now, I'm a hyper-visual person. So to me, having my eyes open during sex definitely wanted to happen, but not necessarily facing my partner. So it feels disconnecting sometimes from my partner, and having the lights off. No, I want the lights on. I want to see everything, you know. I want that stimulation, you know, but the eye to eye contact, not so much. So that feels sort of impersonal, or it may feel objectificating. And you know, I don't know, maybe it is to some extent. And again, some of that with sex is, you know, what we're doing too, is pretty normal. But those are sort of my experiences, both with the platonic touch, sexual touch, cuddling, and also visual stuff.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because one of the things that I think is so difficult is to talk about what feels good, you know, and for a lot of people, I don't have a problem with that. And maybe that's intimidating to some men, but I've not had a problem with sharing what I want and what I need, but I don't think that I'm common how I feel is common.
Yes.
Right. So one of the things I listened to this podcast, it's Sex with Emily. I think it is one of the best podcasts out there regarding sex. And she just addresses everything. And she has a, I think it's a 2 or 3 page checklist that you can download. I think you have to give your email and then you can download it for free. And it has, I want to say, like 100 different things that couples or individuals might be interested in doing related to physical intimacy and sexual intimacy. And it's like a yes, no, maybe checklist. Mm-hmm. And you can fill it out, give it to your partner and ask your partner to do the same thing. And then you can go through the yeses and see how you can incorporate those things that are yeses for both of you into your relationship, you know, one at a time. Mm-hmm. But somebody's already done, you know, the checklist for you. So I would highly recommend that to folks that are wanting to understand each other's needs and then work towards making some of those things a reality in their sex life. I also think that many of us are afraid to explore our own bodies or to have our partners explore our bodies so that we can learn together what we enjoy. And so here's maybe a way that neurodiverse couples can do this, to think of it as an exploration, you know, like almost like a treasure hunt, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe take sex off the table, And just we're going to explore and see what feels good to each other or one at a time. Because I don't know, and maybe you can share some light on this. I don't know what it would be like to have alexithymia, to be physically attracted to my partner, but not really understand what I'm feeling and what I'm needing.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So that's, I guess, a tool and a process couples can use. I don't know if you have any other things that you've shared with folks or any other ideas.
Yeah, I really like the idea of defining parameters around the sexual activity, just like we talked about with cuddling, like what is this going to look like, and what do we want to get out of it? What are the goals? What will we do today? And being able to bridge that with your partner feels good. Now, it's also, like you mentioned, can be very intimidating, like you said, particularly if you're unsure or you don't know what's right or you don't know what's wrong or you don't know how you really feel, all the, and so. And there is shyness and shame and all kinds of things that get pulled in here that can make it difficult to do that. But once you're able to, and I think it's really freeing and it really can really feel good, I think of, someone like you, Mona, who's very open, not shy at all. Again, to me, that would be intimidating. Like this person knows more than me, and I don't know what I can ask for, or I don't know what this should look like, in the same ways that, hyperverbal partners with less verbal partners also can get intimidated and can get shut down in that process. So I think there has to be a delicate sort of back and forth and a feeling of pace. And a feeling of what, how do we kind of move into this, right? And I think navigating that in gentle ways, in open ways, in curious ways, in ways that can ask questions, I think super helpful.
Yeah, I agree. And something you said that I think is very important for the listeners to remember is the second you shame your partner for either wanting something or not wanting something, you become an emotionally unsafe person in their lives. And, I think that that happens a lot in relationships, period, where somebody wants to explore, toys or, a threesome or a particular way of having sex or watching porn together or whatever, and their partner judges them and shames them. And that just creates such a disconnect. And so I want to bring that out into the light. Because I think there's nothing worse than maybe there's a lot of things worse, but in this particular conversation, I think something that is so unfortunate is when two people love each other and one has interests or desires that they want to share with the person they love above anybody else, and then they get shamed or criticized or ridiculed, and it happens repeatedly. It just leads to a shutdown and shame, and it's going to be very difficult for your partner to trust you with their needs and feelings and desires. So I just hope all of you who are listening will take that into account. And then I think, Greg, we started talking about the sensory issues, and I think that has come up several times in relationships with various autistic men that I've been with. And, for some, it's been, I only have sex with condoms and we don't have to worry about birth control. I'm 60 years old, so that's not an issue. But I understand why it's more than just possibly getting an STI or any kind of disease. It's that way you control whatever is, being ejaculated, whatever is happening in that area, and it's cleaner. And I understand that. And, some men that I've been with, you have to, we both have to take showers before we get into it, right? The bed sheets have to be clean and they have to be washed immediately after. We have to take showers immediately after also. And so understanding what you each need can be so helpful in understanding your sensory sensitivities and limits,
Absolutely agree. I think, like you said, knowing each other's sensory profile, knowing what you need around that, knowing what's too much, what's too little, and that can just look a lot more diverse with autistic individuals. And so, one of my clients said to me one day, I think I might be asexual. And I said, oh, really? So why? Tell me about it. They said, well, it's all too much. There's all these, bodily things that are going on. There's all these different smells. There's all this different intensity happening. And I just would rather not, And so think about getting that overwhelm, getting stuck in your head, and then at the same time trying to meet the needs of your partner at the same
Too
time,
much.
right? And so, and again, so autistics a lot of times trend towards having more exploration of themselves. And so hypersexuality and masturbation and porn addiction ends up becoming a safer place. Because we can, we can mitigate that experience. We can also control it. We can get exactly what we need in the ways that we want. And we generally have rich internal worlds already and vivid imaginations. And so it's very easy for us to default into these areas if there isn't a lot of safety and understanding and communication and growth with one another, in terms of physical intimacy and sexuality with neurodiverse partners.
That is such an important point, Greg. And, I hear from so many couples and individuals that, they haven't had sex sometimes in years. And yet, one partner is masturbating or watching porn. And so the other partner who's not being engaged in any kind of sexual activity, again, feels rejected. Why don't they want to be with me? They're doing all these other things. And you just explained that perfectly. And so I think that's where, the help of a counselor, a sex therapist, somebody that can help you both understand what you each need and how to move forward and create a safe container for both of you. Because, as I talked about at the beginning, none of us want to feel objectified, like, you're just doing something to fulfill a need. We may want an emotional connection. We may want to know that there are some words that precede the act of sex or, during or after. We don't want to just be a body. And so talking about those things, and sometimes, I hear folks want to schedule sex, and that makes it easier for one partner, but not necessarily for the other, because again, it may feel more robotic. But, and again, I know you're going to have some thoughts on this. By scheduling sex, it allows the neurodivergent partner to prepare, right?
I completely agree with that because there are too many factors that have to be met in order for it to sort of just happen when maybe I'm just wanting it to happen, right? So again, all of the nuance and the expectation, or the buildup in terms of just open intimacy and emotional connection and being close with one another. And again, my experience with my wife and other partners is there needs to be that going on for them to be open with their bodies and to want to become more intimate. I think this can also be a little of a gender thing too, where I think men and even some autistic women are all right with having sex that leads to more emotional connection. So we come at it from two different sides. sometimes. So we have to figure out how to navigate these big differences in perspectives and needs. I think scheduling is a good thing. Like you said, I think it feels safer. It feels like I can prepare. It feels like I can work up to that moment. And it also prevents the difficulties with initiation and rejection. And this is actually a big, big deal. Because as autistics, but also ADHDers tend to have a lot of sensitivity rejection. If you try once and your partner's not interested and you haven't talked about why or what's needed going on here, you're likely to want to go through that again. And then how do you create that bridge back to intimacy and sexuality?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, the rejection sensitivity that all of us neurodivergents or many of us neurodivergents have, you know, and you know, getting over that. If you're repeatedly rejected, and you know, not knowing what you did, is it your body? Is it that you're aging? Is it your wrinkles? Is it, you know, you had a baby and your stomach's no longer flat, whatever. And not being able to talk about that, I think, can be so debilitating for both your self-worth and self-esteem and the relationship. Because if both of you want to have a good, healthy sex life and you have had it at some point in your relationship, which is another thing I hear, you know, when we were first dating or before we had children, things were so much better. And then, you know, we moved in together or we married and we had children and then, you know, everything stopped or really slowed down. And, you know, we've talked about change and transitions and how difficult that can be for the autistic partner and even neurodivergence in general. And so if you've had a good sex life and you've had physical intimacy with each other and you know what it feels like when it's good, that's something that you can explore either together or with the help of a therapist or a counselor, because you both are capable of it. You know, what changed, you may not have talked about what changed that created the distance, but those changes are part of your life. Now, how can you get back to what was good and important to both of you in that area? If it was important, you know, to both of you. Because, you know, one partner may, and we've talked about this before too, might have been just using a script, you know, based on what they thought they needed to do. And, you know, I think it's important to be honest about that. Like if you're asexual or, you know, you're fine with having sex every few months or once a year for birthdays and, you know, anniversaries. And some people are comfortable with that. But if you don't have the discussion and you just stop having sex and that creates, you know, suffering or you feel like you're not wanted or valued, there may be a way forward with the help of a third party.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and it's where there's a disparity of needs and interests that create those problems and sort of amplify disconnection, you know. Well, I'm not going to be heard, or I'm not going to get my needs met in this way, or this isn't going to be interesting enough or exciting enough, or I'm not going to be able to orgasm, or whatever it is. Those things just will continue to lead to more disconnection. I love the thought of building on the good that you've had before, but also finding bridges of understanding, being able to be creative. I think even some turn-taking can be really helpful, like taking off the pressure in terms of performance or deciding who's the focus this time around, I think can also be good, and particularly in terms of you know, mutual orgasm and disappointment that can come from, again, those different ways of timing and wants and needs and the pace of sex and where that goes. And so all that stuff, I think, again, difficult to sometimes navigate on your own. And sometimes you do need somebody to be able to help facilitate those discussions and create safety around them and to really explore them. And to be able to be more creative about what that looks like. And again, there's so much shame a lot of times connected with sexuality, but also all of my clients have gone through sexual abuse. And so autistics end up a lot of times not reading social cues or being fairly naive or not knowing what's expected or what's being suggested. And we get ourselves into very difficult situations, not just women, but men as well. And it's really scary to see the numbers. And also the tendency to not report it, because also a lot of neurodivergents think that it was my fault. I didn't read the cues. I didn't understand about what was expected. And I've been taught to be compliant because I've grown up being resistant. Or there's a lot of times we have to teach a lot of self-advocacy for autistics. So we need to be encouraged to say what we need, and to be able to take up space and feel like we belong and can ask for those things can also be difficult. And so all of that plays into all of this.
I so agree. And I know a lot of folks that I've talked to talk about, trauma. You talked about sexual abuse. It could be trauma around some relational trauma where, they tried to kiss somebody and they read the cues wrong, or, reached out to hold a hand and were told, "No, I'm not interested in you like that," or, what have you. And, they've asked for consent and were given consent, but then, somebody, they weren't trustworthy and they said, "No, I never gave you consent." So all these traumatic experiences can really play into how your physical intimacy and sexual intimacy with your long-term partner, the person that you love and maybe want to be with for the rest of your life, there's things that you're taking from past relationships or experiences into this relationship that you aren't even aware maybe are affecting you. And again, a therapist or a counselor can help with that. And so, there's so many couples out there that I know this conversation is going to be, it's going to resonate with them and it's going to be helpful. I'm wondering, are there other things that we haven't touched on that you think, based on your experience with the couples and the individuals you work with in your therapy practice, things that you think might be helpful for us to talk about or explore?
I think we've touched on some really important things that I guess I'd go back to. And I think autistic people in general need to explore more of their interest and also connecting those to their values. Autistic people can be extremely loyal people, but we have a lot of trouble with infidelity in neurodiverse relationships. And a lot of it comes from the neurodivergent partner. And I think once we understand the sexual game or understand a ways of connection, and we have trouble with boundaries, so that can seem really exciting and enticing. But if it doesn't align with, again, parts of us that really believe in fairness and loyalty and value-based beliefs, and those end up conflicting, this is where we do a lot of damage in our relationships. And so creating more awareness around our needs and being able to get those with our partners is helpful in terms of these problems as well. Sexuality, physical touch, like you've talked about, for a lot of us are really important. And just because it's hard to talk about doesn't mean that we shouldn't be talking about it, So I really hope that this discussion can help normalize and open up discussion around these things, and awareness around shame, diversity of needs, sensory stuff, social conditioning and influences, and trauma are all huge parts of how this all plays out for us.
Yeah, I agree. That was a great way to wrap it up. And for those folks that missed the communication workshop that Greg and I co-facilitated, we are now offering it as a recorded workshop. So we've recorded it. And if you and your partner are interested in purchasing that workshop, it's available. It's $97 and it comes with the communication workshop workbook, which basically outlines all the things we discuss in the workshop. It's about 2 hours, and we've gotten great responses from people who watched it. They found it so helpful. And you can go on to my website at Neurodiverse Love and go to my shop. And I think I'll put a link in the show notes for those folks that are interested in that. And then Greg and I are going to do a few more podcasts together. We're going to address a number of other topics, including alexithymia. We're going to talk about monotropism. We're going to talk about demand avoidance and unidentified autism. And then in the future, we are going to co-facilitate a support group together. And we've heard from a lot of folks that have really enjoyed the podcasts and the workshops we've done together. And so we hope to be able to offer that in the next few months. And we hope to be able to talk to some of you and answer your questions and help facilitate some discussions that we think will be really beneficial to neurodiverse couples out there. So, Greg, thank you again for another fantastic conversation. And do you want to let people know where they can reach out to you?
Absolutely. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm doing coaching and consulting on the side. My email is gfuqua70@gmail.com. I also have a website, gregfuqua.com. Feel free to reach out to me with interest questions that you have. And always really appreciate our talks, Mona. And the work we're doing, I'm hoping really has some positive impact for people.
Amen. Me too. Thank you so much, Greg. It was another great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.